Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 6 of How to Survive 2025. I am Daisha M. Arnold.
I'm Brian Keene.
I'm Jim Cobb.
And we have the coolest guy today as our very first guest on the show. Welcome, Dr. Baker. So Todd Baker is a doctor of emergency medicine. He is currently serving as the medical director for his local EMS. Is it TCAD?
Tannehill County Ambulance. Yes,
ma'am. Awesome. So Dr. Baker served as the chief of the ER for the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Ibn Sina in Baghdad, Iraq, and this was known as Baghdad ER. Aside from being a highly decorated war veteran, Dr. Baker is also an author, an inventor, an entrepreneur, a husband, a father, and a huge asset to his community. So welcome, Dr. Baker.
Thanks so much, guys. It's great to be here.
I guess my first question is, why didn't we think to just have Dr. Baker as the fourth member of this show? I mean, that bio, what, my God.
I don't know about that. I like to have many titles, but a master of not much, to be honest with you.
So something that we want to touch on that's going to segue into National Suicide Awareness Month is that Dr. Baker wrote a book. And in this book that I read a few years ago when COVID kicked off, I read a piece in there about how Dr. Baker is the leader of the physicians in the emergency room in Baghdad. They collectively decided that no one was going to freak out in front of anybody ever. And for this very reason, like I'm serious, because we were children. Dr. Baker, how old were you when we were in Baghdad? Because I was 23.
I was probably 32, 33.
I can't, even at 33, can't imagine that responsibility. But that decision that the three of you made to not freak out, to not yell at us, to be very intentional, to make sure that we never question ourselves, and that you guys never question us in front of everybody, was probably one of the main reasons why I was able to walk away and be relatively as okay as one is in an emergency room. So thank you for that. That was really eye-opening. And we've talked about being, when you're the one in charge and you're the one people are looking to in a crisis, that you are the one that is setting the example and the tone for the emotion and what's going on. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that. So
it is, September is National Suicide Awareness Month. I do want to call out that if anyone, any listeners at any point in time, you feel like this is it, you've had enough, you feel hopeless, helpless, please, if you do nothing else, make one more phone call to 988. It is the nationwide suicide hotline, and they're there to walk you through whatever's going on.
And it's important to note that it is okay to feel like that, folks.
Yep.
As we said in the pilot episode of this show, regardless of your political affiliation, of your gender, of your religion, of any sort of ideologue or ism, these are tough times. Everybody is feeling it. And if we can admit that to each other, I think that helps in building a bridge and reuniting people. But you are not going through it alone, even if you think you're going through it alone, even as Daisha likes to say, international rock star best-selling horror writers go through it from time to time. I'm here to admit to that. So yeah, absolutely, reach out. You know, there are resources out there. All you have to do is take advantage of them.
And if you don't know what to do, just tell someone you don't know what to do and pass that responsibility, because they will help you.
Yep. And like Brian said, it's okay to not be okay. And that's the first step to understanding that you're going to need help, that we all need help to get through a lot of the stuff that's going on right now. Nobody can do it alone. It's okay to not be okay, and it's okay to ask for help. Don't feel like you need to toughen up. Don't feel like, you know, well, a guy doesn't ask for help. You know, that's bullshit. Everybody needs help. Extend the hand and somebody will be there to take it.
Yep.
Ooh, and on that note, we have some very pressing questions for you, Dr. Baker.
Super hey, we started pressing. Out heavy and we're just going to get heavier.
So most women know how to use a tampon. But in the case of a gunshot wound, is that appropriate or even helpful?
Yeah, good question. I know that's been around for a while, hasn't it?
It has.
You know,
it's a shape.
Yeah. Well, think about it. When somebody has a nosebleed, you know, we use a rhino rocket or something like that, like a nasal tampon that we put in. To be honest with you, little different scenario though, right? The nose versus a cavitating GSW, you know. So you know, a lot depends. Is it a full metal jacket? And you don't know these things. I mean, you know, is it a hunting round that's going to mushroom and create this huge, you know, permanent temporary cavity, or is it going to be a full metal jacket round that's going to be an in and out without a big exit hole, or you know? And so I would digress, and I would actually shift gears and say. And Daisha, you know this from our experience. You can stop bleeding with one finger, right? I mean, major arterial bleeds, one finger, not wrapping it up in 75 dressings and towels and everything else, but one finger of direct pressure right where the bleeder is. Now, that might mean you're stuck there holding that for the next 12 hours, I guess. I don't know. Have to figure it out after you've done that, right? But if you've got, you know, I'd have to think an entry wound here is going to be too small for a tampon. So I don't think that's a go on the entry side. Maybe if it's a hunting round that's going to mushroom or whatever, or cause a larger cavity on the exit wound side, you could shove something in. But are you going to get that direct pressure right there at the bleeder with a tampon? Or are you going to get it with your finger? And I'm not advocating shoving fingers into everything, but, you know, I'm just saying you got to get direct pressure. And so I guess in some scenarios, sure, maybe it would do the trick, but I certainly would not say that's my go-to.
So tampons are usually kept in very discreet places, like a gunshot wound. Am I going to go run and find a tampon and just to use it?
And let me make a confession here. I'm the one who originally presented that question. Okay.
That was you.
That was me. Now, and here's why. Because, like the good doctor mentioned, this has been around for a long time. This tip, for lack of a better term. And it's a big bone of contention in prepper circles where you'll have somebody who will say, make sure you put tampons in your first aid kit in case of a gunshot wound. And then you have other people who come in and say, that's not the right tool for the job. If you're stocking a first aid kit, go with the best tool for the job. And then it, you know, it being social media, it devolves from there. So I wanted to bring in a real expert on this discussion to find out, you know, what the good doctor would say about this.
Well, like I say, I don't know if I'd call myself an expert, but if you think about it, with all of the hemostatic gauze that's out there from the Z folds, you know, and everything else, if you have an exit, once again, I don't think an entrance wound is even up for debate because it'd be so small, I would think. I guess maybe a shotgun, but you know what I mean. If you had an exit wound big enough that you could shove a tampon in through there, I would think you could take either, once again, your finger or a pin or something like that with Z fold actual hemostatic gauze. That's what I have in my bag. And I would shove all of that down in there, you know, with, once again, your finger or a pin or something, you know, something like that, holding it up there to the sides of the cavity to get your pressure. I think that would be a whole lot better than a tampon.
Dr. Baker, you brought up your bag. And Daisha, I don't mean to.
That's okay. Go for it.
A question that I've seen from some of our listeners, and it's one that I have myself. You know, we try to give out practical information for families, for single moms, for folks living in urban areas, living in rural areas. When we talk about a basic first aid kit for a preparation sort of scenario, what are some of the things that you think, you know, as Dr. Baker, what would you have in your first aid kit? You know, let's say a hurricane comes and it's like New Orleans, you're without power for 4 weeks. What do you make sure you have there at home to take care of the family?
Good question. And there's no right and no wrong answer, right? You know, everybody's a little bit different in what their comfort level is and what they may or may not need. You know, if you have somebody in your home that has a significant medical condition, you know, a diabetic or something like that, you know, you may lean more this direction, or somebody that has hemophilia and they're a bleeder, you may lean more that direction, you know. But just to answer the question in general, obviously, big things I would think of would be like different injury patterns or organ systems, as in, okay, well, obviously you need your cuts and bruises all the way up through significant wounds, right?
Right.
So, you know, I would want some triple antibiotic ointment. I would want some, you know, some sort of gauze, you know, dressings, whatever, for minor stuff. And then all the way up through, like I say, I like to have a hemostatic dressing around. Once again, that's a little bit more on the severe spectrum. I'm not going to use that unless I need it. Those are expensive and harder to come by, but I'm going to have one.
Is that something a civilian can go buy? Like, can you walk into CVS and buy hemostatic dressing?
I don't know if you can at CVS, but you can on Amazon.
Can you?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And you may can it at CVS, but you definitely can on the internet. They're expensive. And like I say, I certainly wouldn't use it for a basic cut, but just something I like to have around. But, you know, that's kind of, I think, of the skin type stuff as far as that goes. Ace bandages to hold that on, or some Coband that you can get just to hold dressings in place. And then I think of broken bones, right? And, you know, I love splints, like a SAM splint. I always keep around. Once again, something you can get off of Amazon or wherever. And those are those splints that fold up pretty flat, and then they'll expand out. It's like a pliable metal. And then once again, use your ACE bandage or your Coband or your Curlex band to hold in place. And a splint doesn't cure anything. You know, people think, oh my gosh, you have to have a splint because you broke something. Well, a splint doesn't fix the break, right? But just helps kind of support it and put some of the pressure out around the fracture site versus directly right at the fracture site. And so just helps with comfort, essentially, over time, as far as that goes. And then I think of medications, and I try to think of the counter meds. I mean, hey, it's great if you can have, you know, anti-nausea meds, antibiotics, things of that nature. If you can get some prescription drugs, that's great, but not everybody can get their hands on that, obviously. And so simple things, nausea, you can take rubbing alcohol or an alcohol pad, and you can actually hold that to your nose. Yeah, Daisha, absolutely. Hold it to your nose, and that helps with nausea somewhat. We use that in the ER sometimes, on the ambulances, simple things like that. You don't have to have a prescription for that. As far as that goes. And then and medications, you know, always think ibuprofen, always think Tylenol, just some pain medicine type stuff. You'd be amazed at how well those work together when you take them together. They work through two totally separate mechanisms, like the NSAIDs, which is ibuprofen and naproxen or Aleve, Motrin is what those are, work over here through prostaglandin mediation. And then Tylenol works through a whole different mechanism. And so you can take them together, and a significant relief of obviously fever, pain, whatever else, as far as that goes. I love having Pepcid, the over-the-counter stomach medicine. Pepcid works for allergic reactions.
I didn't know that.
Of course, helps for your stomach, and for heartburn, you know, what it's made for as an acid reducer, but it's a histamine type 2 reducer. And so actually all allergic reactions, we give Pepcid to, standard of care, in medicine circles, along those
no
lines.
Idea.
Yep. Pepcid. Love it. Along those lines, Benadryl, of course. I always joke and say, if I'm on a desert island, Benadryl is the one medicine I would want with me, because it obviously helps you sleep if you have to sleep. Right. It actually has a little anti-nausea effect to it. It's an antihistamine, of course, has some anti-nausea effect to it. It can be used for motion sickness or things, you know, seasickness, things of that nature. Once again, not the gold standard, but still helpful on the side. And then obviously allergic reactions can be helpful with that. And so it actually can help with a ton of things. And so Benadryl is one I always want to keep around as far as part of my supply. Medications wise, those are the things I would think of. If I could have nausea medicine like Zofran or something like that, that's great to have and just keep and hang on to. Diarrhea medicine, of course, you know, Imodium over the counter. Like it or not, it's part of life. And so you definitely want to have Imodium in your cupboard at home. No question about it. Those are just kind of thinking of the, you know, kind of what would cover the most things in a simple thing. Now, as far as a bag versus in the home, you know, that you had mentioned there, Brian, you know, space blankets, right? They're tiny. You can take them on the go. They work if you're, well, it's not like they cure you or anything, once again, but they're helpful if you're cold. They're helpful if you're warm on both, you know. They're fantastic, lightweight things that you can always have with you wherever you go that could be significantly helpful.
Awesome.
So two things you didn't mention, and probably this would be more of an on-the-go bag, but Narcan is now over the counter. And I know, like, if you're just home, it's you and, you know, your kids are still in school. But even like kids still in school, especially as they get older in high school, they start experimenting. Like, I think that everyone should have Narcan.
I've got it with me in my bag. Yeah.
And then does everyone need four tourniquets for their forelimbs? You didn't mention anything about tourniquets.
I figured that was coming, so that's why I didn't. Hey, no questions asked, Aisha, and you obviously would agree with this, and feel free to chime in because you are a tourniquet expert as well. How many tens of thousands of people are alive from the past 20 years because of tourniquets? And I would easily put it in the tens of thousands, if not more, over 20 years of the war on terror. Now, did all of the people that got tourniquets need tourniquets? Well, of course not. You know, I mean, remember we'd see a lot of people that have a little scratch and they'd have a tourniquet, but you know what? It's just like I told you guys. I would rather somebody come in that had a tourniquet on for an hour or two that didn't need it. Just like with you guys, I'd rather you put in 9 IVs and we don't need any than to not have done one and we needed it. And then we have a bad outcome where we could have helped somebody. And the same, in my opinion, goes for tourniquets. No, of course, you don't want to be tourniqueting everything. I've got that. Violence of action. you want to be, I would be over aggressive versus under aggressive. That being said, the caveat, once again, go back to where we started. One finger will stop bleeding in the right place. You don't need a tourniquet. You need one finger. We'll usually do the trick.
Awesome. So if like if I'm out hiking, because I moved to Pennsylvania, it's really, really pretty and we're out hiking and we've got snakes, we have venomous snakes. So if I get bit by a venomous snake, like, can I legitimately ask my husband to suck out the venom? Is that going to help me or am I just going to,
is it helpful? Well, there's an old joke that there are two guys out in the woods and one got bit on the rear end by a snake and they didn't know what to do. So say, go get the doctor. So ran 2 hours back to the doctor, asked him what to do. He said, you got to suck out the venom. So then the guy ran 2 hours back, got back to his buddy. And the buddy said, well, what do you do? What are you doing? He said, the doctor said, you're going to die. So it's funny that you mention it. This morning, mountain biking, I am not a good mountain biker. And so I was on a steep section. And so I ain't riding up or down that thing. I'm walking, you know, for that 20 yards. And I'm walking and my front tire comes right up on a copperhead just a few hours ago. And it goes back up, you know, just gave him a minute and eventually it slid off and all was good. But great question. No, do not do that. Do not do that. Snake bites in the United States, you know, we have three, essentially we have four types of venomous snakes. You know, you got the coral snake, which can kind of count different with the neurotoxin. But, you know, basically three generic groups of pit vipers, right? Copperheads, cotton mouse or water moccasins, and then rattlesnake family. And so I don't want to be bit by any of them. However, for the most part, extremely few people die from snake bites in the United States. I mean, barely anybody. And once again, I don't mean that. Of course, heaven forbid if somebody's listening that, you know, had a family member or something. But just in general, generically, people don't die in the United States from snake bites. And so you want to, you essentially just want to get to healthcare as quick as you can, but you don't want to run. You want to rest. You want to, you know, do the best you can, splint that injured, you know, if it's on the ankle or whatever, splint it in position of comfort, try to do crutches. It's not like you're going to have those out in the woods, but you know what I'm saying? You just take it as easy as you can and get back to health. No tourniquets for sure. No tourniquets. Certainly not sucking the wound out.
Gross.
Excellent. That's another one that pops up in a lot of survival kits, are a little snake bite kit with a suction cup and a little razor blade that you're supposed to make an X on the bite and use the suction cup and all that. Yeah. And it's just nonsense, you know. And again, thank you for elaborating on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just funny. I just happened to run into one today.
That is nuts. All right. So, Dr. Baker, you still do rotations in the emergency room. What is the most common mechanism of injuries you see in the emergency room?
Oh gosh. Good question. So, you know, older people falling down, honestly, is probably the biggest thing we see. I was amazed when I got out of the Army taking care of young people, you know, and then when I got to community emergency medicine, it's like, man, everybody is falling down, you know, and where I'm at, we live on the giant side of a hill here in a very hilly terrain. And so tons of broken wrist and hip injuries and head injuries from falling, but by far older people falling down. Other than that, you know, car accidents. Are a huge cause. Although to be fair, you know, and you guys know this, you just wear your seatbelt. It is unbelievable the difference. I mean, just unbelievable the difference. We get people that will roll three times, they roll their vehicle three times, get into a car wreck, get out, walk around, and not even have to come to the hospital.
Oh wow!
It is nuts the difference that seatbelts make. If they're not wearing a seatbelt, which is what we get sometimes, then as you can imagine, and you remember overseas, Desha, we that wasn't a thing there. Mm-hmm. And there were some pretty gnarly injuries that we had with that.
Everyone's too cool for school. You don't want to wear their seatbelt.
Absolutely. So lots of motorcycle wrecks, bike wrecks, you know, things of that nature are the big things that I would tell you that we see. We don't see a ton of penetrating trauma. I'm in a community hospital. Yeah. And so, you know, you get your occasional stab or GSW, you know, but that's not a big thing that we get that I'm dealing with now.
Let's talk, dig a little deeper on that. Listeners will remember during our two-part mindset episode, we talked about when I got burned, my accident, you know, and to recap for Dr. Baker, who probably wasn't listening, third degree here on the elbow, third and second degree mixed down this arm, second degree up here. I knew I was in shock. I also knew that I needed to stay calm. I also knew that I did not have health insurance, and this was going to cost me a pretty penny. But during that discussion, Desha, we brought up, you know, keeping a cool head, being the one who's not losing their shit, even if you're the one who's injured. Dr. Baker, what are some personal tips and tricks for keeping a cool head in a crisis situation? You know, when there's chaos going down and there's blood everywhere and there's people injured, how do you stay focused? How do you keep your cool?
Great question. You know, I got to go back. When I was, actually, I'm going to answer that in two parts. So the first part, The first part, I would go back to 2001 and when I was an intern. So you do for medical school, you know, you do 4 years of college, you do 4 years of medical school, and you learn all this stuff. But in all honesty, you can't treat the common cold. You don't know how to be a doctor and how to take care of people. That's what residency is for. So show up at residency at Fort Hood, Texas, and Tennessee Congressman Mark Green, he was one of my senior residents. And so Mark Green, and he may not remember this, I don't know, I'd have to ask him, but he sits us down and Daisha, I don't know if I went over this with you guys or not, I have no idea. But he sits us down and says, listen, you guys, you know, not in a rude way, but listen, you guys are idiots. You're worthless. You are not helpful in the emergency department at all. You are in the way, essentially. We're in that are just starting, right? And he said, but those nurses and those medics that are out there have been doing this, you know, the medics for several years and the nurses, some of them civilian nurses, been doing this for 30 years. They don't need you to tell them what to do. They know what to do. They know what to do better than you do, right? This is what they do, emergency medicine. And he said, but if you don't go out there and you don't lead and lead the team, then they will not follow you. So you're not going to know the right choice. You're not going to know exactly for each decision point that you get to. You're not going to know, oh, I guarantee we need to go right instead of going left. But as the leader, violence of action supersedes intellect of thought. And he said, you got to step up and you got to make a choice. And if you're wrong, you got to own it and back up and go the other direction. And in all fairness to us as interns, the nurses knew what was going on. So if I went in there and said, everybody go right, you know, the nurses were like, hey, turn, go left. You know, and so they guided us and they helped us as we learned how to do it. But the whole point being, and the whole point he made was, you gotta stop, make a decision and go. You can't sit in indecision. So be that in someone else's crisis or be that in your own crisis, at any point, you know, what is it they say? You got to get off the X, right? And so you either got to get yourself off the X or get them off the X or both. And so in all honesty, that's how, and that's the mentality I took into Baghdad. Wow. With our team as well, because, you know, at the point I got to Baghdad, I was a board certified emergency physician. Hey, that's great. Okay. I had done residency. Everything's good. But I didn't do, I mean, you know, I saw a gunshot wound once every now and then. I had certainly never seen anybody with their legs blown off. That's not what we do in the United States, right? And so we step in there and we say, okay, if we sit in here as, you know, the people that have to be in charge of the room and we're petrified because we've never done this before, how does that reflect on our nurses and medics? And so you gotta step up and make a call. So you just reach back in your head with what information you do have and what experience you do have or don't have, you put it together and you make a call. And sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong, but I've learned that 90% of the time you're going to be right. And so that's kind of the way I looked at it and the way I did it. And then the second part answer, I think I listened to a lot of Jocko and Jocko Willing. And some of the things he says, I love what he says about stop, look around and make a call. And so in a crisis situation, if you're diving off head off in and you just in the panic and in the chaos, be it for yourself or be it for your team, you're not being helpful. You have to stop, assess the situation. Another one he says is prioritize and execute. Prioritize step one, step two, step three and go. And you're going to be wrong sometimes. And immediately you got to say, oh, back up, go to step C instead of step A, you still have to do that to be moving forward and getting control of the situation. I don't know if that answers your question, but that
it does. Yeah, absolutely.
It does. And it echoes a point Jim has made in the past about like, if you're in a situation and you're flight kicks in and you just freeze, just try to get yourself to take one step forward, do one thing, like you said, Dr. Baker, get off of X.
Yep.
Yeah. One thing at a
very
time.
Important. I had a question, and this circles back to when we were talking about what to keep on hand in your kits and things like that. how important is it for the average family to have a stockpile of various antibiotics versus, you know, over-the-counter meds, things like that? There are companies out there now, Jace Medical is one of them, where you can purchase a supply of antibiotics, and they, you know, have various configurations of kits, everything from, you know, the very common to what I would think might be a little more obscure. And it just makes me wonder, how necessary is that type of investment for the average family who's interested in being better prepared for emergencies?
We just bought a Jace case, actually. Okay. The little four pack of antibiotics. And I can't off the top of my head think of the four antibiotics, but these pills are massive. They are massive. They're huge. And I mean, they're for an adult, but like, I'm an adult. I can't swallow these things. They're huge, huge. But like, I don't know, but it was $300 for just four antibiotics. And then you get like this spiral bound little booklet about this big and an inch thick. And the writing is like 7-point font. Mm-hmm. And so you need like a magnifying glass to read it. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't get a Jace case.
Right, right.
But well, go ahead, Tim.
Part of this spins out of the popularity of what's often called fish mocks in the prepper world, okay? For years and years and years, you could go into pet supply stores and you could buy amoxicillin. Mm-hmm. It was for fish, but it was the same stuff that they were, you know, also selling for human beings. I will readily admit that for a long time, we didn't have health insurance. And when I had an issue, that's where I went if I needed an antibiotic. And Brian, you know, you're nodding your head. I'm sure you've done the same thing.
Yeah, I tell a famous story. Best-selling author, Dr. F. Paul Wilson, who was a general practitioner for, I think, 50 years, 40 years. I emailed him once and I said, hey, if I have a character who knows they have an ear infection, and they don't have, you know, they don't have access to a doctor, and they use you know, this antibiotic from the pet store. Will that work? Will that kill them? And he said, well, you know, it's not tested by the FDA, and there may be some purity issues, but yes, it would possibly help the ear infection. And you still don't have
for your character.
Yeah, I'm not proud of it, but I've done it once or twice.
Right.
Yeah,
and I guess the root of my question is, how necessary is it, do you feel, for the average family to have these on hand? And this is important right now because you can't get fish mocks at pet stores anymore. You can't buy it at Amazon anymore because various and sundry entities have closed down those avenues. And now you can't even buy pet medication without a prescription. So people are turning to, you know, the Jace Medical or similar companies, which is a substantial increase in investment price-wise. You know, a bottle of fish mocks was like $20. You know, Dace is spending $300.
So apparently it's an increase in the size of the pill too.
Yeah, exactly. So all of that said, go.
I'd be curious to know what the antibiotic, and Dacia, to clarify, four different types of antibiotics or four pills?
No, four different types of antibiotics. And it's a basic case. So give me just a second. I'll pull it up. But if you can.
A layman at home in Minnesota who's just buying this in case, you know, things get worse in America in 2025. Are they gonna know which antibiotic goes to which thing? I mean, does the booklet give?
That's what the booklet's supposed to be for.
It's so convoluted.
That's a little scary.
That little booklet covers like everything that you could possibly get, so that they only need one version of it. So it's everything in there. But this one has azithromycin. I can't read on here. Amoxicillin. An ad. Ivermectin. Oh, I can't say this one.
Take a stab at it.
No. Step you fast. Can get albuterol. You can get Valcyclovir, apparently. let's see. I mean, if you have an emergency outbreak of HSV, then acyclovir is going to be your friend. But there's, there's like markups and stuff like that. But it is just a four basic kit. Yeah.
Okay. So, and once again, nothing's absolute, right? So I'm sure somebody's going to get it and they're going to do it exactly perfect and they're going to be glad that they got it. And so I'm not at all, by all means, if that's something that someone wants to do and they want to research it, then great. I think most people who were sitting on antibiotics or expensive medications, those medications are going to expire long before they're ever going to use them. Case in point, antibiotics, general antibiotics, amoxicillin, Zithromax or whatever, like for my family and me and most doctors, we don't use antibiotics when people get sick in our family because it's a virus and it's not going to help and we don't use it. And then that way, whenever we're 80, the antibiotics are going to work for us because, our family and ourselves haven't been exposed to it near as much. It just makes me curious as to whether the antibiotics may get used, but did they truly need to be used? Was it a viral thing or whatever, whenever people are using it for? And then also the other effect of the side effects of the antibiotics. So, antibiotic use, of course, it leads to resistance, but also can lead to GI issues. The big thing is GI stuff. And so can lead to Clostridium difficile or pseudomembranous colitis. And once you get C. diff, then there ain't no going back. And that's from antibiotics. So Zithromax is a common one. It's a great antibiotic, but one of the big side effects is diarrhea and GI upset. Okay, well, now I had a viral cold for 2 days. Now I'm taking my supply of Zithromax. Now I've got diarrhea, but I didn't have any diarrhea medicine. And if I'd have just waited 3 days, I'd have been better anyway. Once again, I'm sure it's great for some people. I'm not knocking it, but I think most people would never use it and it just expire.
Fair enough.
Can you take expired medications?
Yes, it loses its potency. It's not going to kill you, but it loses its potency over time. Different medicines at different rates. I don't throw out meds when they're just a few months or a year expired, though.
Okay. Does everyone need to stock supply of saline IV bags?
If you're going to be, if you got somebody to do the IV, I guess, once again, same thing before that's expired. No. Oral rehydration works just as fast as IV rehydration, assuming you don't throw it up, of course. But oral is just as good. Of course, tap water for washing out cuts. You don't need saline for that. Obviously not dirty water, contaminated water, but any clean water, for washing wounds. And so put it this way, I don't keep saline around.
Mm-mm, I don't either.
How about suture kits? That's another real popular one in the prepper world. I'm telling you, some of these preppers, they have a really weird fascination with wound care, particularly suture.
Gross wound care.
Are we just going back to Rambo? Is it all because of Rambo?
I don't know. I don't know. It drives me nuts because when you bring up first aid kits in some of these social media forums, one of the first things people will mention is make sure you have a suture kit. And I'm like, why? Who are you suturing up? How often do you think this is going to be needed? And I guess, let me ask this. How often would you say the average person would need to suture up another average person?
Yeah, great question. Easy answer. Never.
I haven't sutured anyone since I got out.
With wounds, so wounds are going to heal and your scar is going to be bigger. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what suturing does is suturing helps the scar be much, much more aesthetic in the future. So that's good. But what suturing also does is increase the risk of infection. So here we are, we're not anywhere around medical facilities. I've got this wound. I'm going to assume it's a dirty wound or a contaminated wound because I'm out wherever it is I'm out and about. And so now when I suture that, I'm going to increase the risk of that dirty contaminated wound getting infected. And now I'm going to need those antibiotics that I said, which is what I did. all because of suture the wound, that if I'd have just dressed it and let it heal by cleaned it, dressed it, let it heal by secondary intent, then would never have been a problem in the first place. Although I would have a bigger scar, which could be cool, you know?
Yeah.
Depending on where it is.
Sure.
You talk about cleaning wounds. My husband wants to hydrogen peroxide everything, but I was always taught soap and water as the medical professional.
Yes, ma'am. Soap and water. Absolutely. We don't betadine them like crazy. Soaking things in betadine. We don't hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide does kill the bugs, but also kills living tissue.
I didn't know that. It looks cool.
Does look cool, all bubbling up and doing all that stuff, exactly. But no, you're exactly right. Soap and water, tap water. In the ER, I literally use tap water. I have to go hold the wound under the sink for 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm. What about alcohol? Same as hydrogen peroxide?
That's kills just both. Torture. That's not nice.
Yeah, that's just mean. good question. I don't want to say I don't know as far as does it kill tissue. I don't know that answer.
Right.
Tap water.
Now, to clarify, Brian, you're not talking about imbibing alcohol. You're talking about pouring.
I'm gonna imbibe if it's a solar flare CME knocked out the power grid and Daisha has to suture me up because I stepped on a punji stick trying to raid the neighbor's house. Then yeah, I'm gonna imbibe.
But I
always think back to my granddaddy, who we've talked about before, the old moonshiner during Prohibition. And, I don't think he ever went to a doctor until he turned 80. And it was a requirement to check into the old folks home. His wound care was, he'd pour whatever he was brewing in the still on the cut. And, as a child, I always thought that was badass. As an adult, I'm like, why didn't you just go to a doctor?
And he looked at you and said, Brian, I don't have health insurance.
All
right. Fair enough.
Oh, so we're getting to the end of our episode. So one last question for you, Dr. Baker, because our listeners are people, they're young people in their 20s. They're people who are older with kids that are outside of their house, have kids of their own. What is the number one thing that every person can do to keep themselves safe and keep themselves healthy?
Keep moving. It's inertia. An object in motion stays in motion. An object at rest stays at rest. Keep moving. Walk. Take the stairs. Don't take the elevator. We always say, eating healthy and keep moving. And I'm learning as I get older about eating healthier and everything. Even as a doctor, I've got so much to learn on that, to be honest with you guys. But the one thing I know is you've got to keep moving. Mm-hmm. And so that would be the biggest, to answer the question. You obviously want to eat good. You want to be aware of the environment around you, pay attention to what's going on, but just if there's one thing you would tell me to do, I'd say stay in motion.
Wow.
I'm telling you, it just, as I'm aging and as I see people age, it's just brutal, for those who have just been stationary for 30 years.
Good to know.
Yep.
We learned a lot today, gang. We learned that we're going to have to do a whole episode for our older listeners on the dangers of gravity and how
falling.
But Dr. Baker, seriously, thank you. Where can folks find your books? Are they in print?
It's more Kindle now. There's not a whole lot of them in print around now, to be quite honest with you. And I've kind of moved on from that to to our product we invented and stuff, but and just working all the time in the ER. But Kindle is the big place to find it.
All right. Good to know. All right, Dacius, you've been doing the hosting duties this episode, so I think it's only right that you take us out
for this episode. All right. Are we going to keep with our closing? I don't remember what it is. What was it?
It's going to be okay.
It is going to be okay. I'm going to write it down because it is. It's going to be okay, everyone. Thanks for tuning in another week, and we'll see you next time.
Peace.